Beyond the Dark on Radio City 96.7 and City Talk 105.9.
Let's go to America now and speak to a very interesting lady who is an investigator of the paranormal experience and has a book out called There's Something Under the Bed. It's Ursula Bielski. Hello, Ursula.
Hello, how are you tonight, Pete?
You're welcome. Do you know what I've got to tell you before we get on to the serious stuff? Your name has been driving me mad all day because I've never heard the name before. And then I remembered I'd heard it once and once only. And do you know where I heard it? It was in the film The Producers. It's in one of the songs, Bielski, Bielski, Bielski. And I told Jonathan, it's been driving me mad, and then it just hit me. First time I'd heard it. It was amazing. And it was a wonderful film. So I just thought I'd tell you that. Right, welcome to England.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, you have a huge reputation in Chicago, and we're very flattered that you joined us tonight. Tell us who you are.
Well, I have been investigating the paranormal around Chicago for about 23 years. When I started officially investigating, I've just had my seventh book out, which is There's Something Under the Bed. That's my first national title. All of my other books are about Chicago's haunted history in particular. And, you know, I've been investigating for about 23 years, but I have been interested in the paranormal since I was a little girl. I grew up in a house we believed was haunted, so my earliest memory is of hearing ghostly footsteps on the stairs. And all of these experiences have also gone into creating Chicago Hauntings Ghost Tours. We do haunted history tours of Chicago year-round, and we're in our seventh year of operation right now.
Why do you think so many people are fascinated by the other side?
There's so many reasons for it. I think the number one reason is why we're fascinated with anything unknown. I know when I was a little girl, people say, well, you grew up in a haunted house, so this is normal to you and it wasn't frightening to you. But it was really very much to the contrary. We never were comfortable with it. We always felt sort of unstable. And I think I grew up having this sort of skewed perception of reality. I never quite knew what was real and what was not real and what I was expected to believe and what I was expected to not believe. And that's really where the book comes from as well. But anything that we don't understand is always going to have a fascination for us. And of course, just the idea of death and trying to get proof that there is something beyond that is one of the great pursuits of mankind going back forever. We want to go on. We absolutely want to go on, and we want to know what happens after. And all of the pursuits of the paranormal, they're all wrapped up in that.
It's a great title, isn't it? I mean, you have to buy it for the title, because when I was a little boy, used to look under the bed every night, and my mother used to say to me, but what if there's something there? Well, I hadn't a clue. I don't know what I'd do if there's something under the bed. I looked under the bed till I was about 18.
You know, 18 is good, because there's so many of us. I've talked to so many people when I was researching the book, and just being aware of these things for, you know, forever. I still do it. I mean, I still make sure that my arm's not hanging over the side of the bed when I go to sleep in case something grabs it. Don't you?
I've got to get them under the covers in case something touches me.
We make sure the closet door is closed when we go to bed. I mean, these are things that stay with us throughout our lives. There's always that little bit of apprehension when we go to bed.
You just reminded me of a dreadful thing I did to a friend of mine called, I'll mention him actually, Frank Gaskin, many, many years ago, and we hid under his bed, two of us, one on one side, and kept touching him.
Oh, no.
And we never told him, ever.
That's just cruel.
And it just jumped back into my mind. I've forgotten all about that. Can you imagine? He was demented.
Oh, I can imagine.
Tell me, though, let's be serious, because it's a serious subject. So many people are interested. And you are interested in children and the paranormal, aren't you?
I am. It's again, it goes back to my own childhood. I mean, I'm very aware of what it's like to have these kinds of experiences. And you know, our parents struggle, and I myself now as a parent struggle to reconcile our children to these experiences without instilling any undue expectation or drama, and without making them afraid, and without, you know, causing them to create things or invent things that aren't there, but to let them know that these things perhaps do happen, and to be accepting of them and to talk about them. And this book came from really a lifetime of being, you know, struggling with my own experiences as a child and as I grew older, and now with my own children. One of the things that happened when I have two daughters, they're 8 and 11 now, when my older daughter was a baby, this is an experience that a lot of parents have, where they will be, you know, crabby, whiny, and crying. There's nothing you can do to console them. And then all of a sudden, they will stop crying. They will look to a point above your shoulder, look up to the ceiling, smile, laugh, and be calmed. And when they get old enough to talk, sometimes they will say the names of a loved one who has died that they never even met, you know, who died before they were born. And this happened with my children, where they would say the name, you know, grandma or grandpa, or the names of uncles that had, or aunts that had passed away before that they were born. Or when they got old enough, they would identify by name aunts and uncles or grandparents from photographs of people that they had never met before and had never seen us talk about before. And this experience is so common with parents, and it's something that's just not even addressed or accepted. It's something that's just brushed off. But it has a great impact on children and on parents, and it really needs to be taken into the body of experiences that parents have.
Now, with you sort of doing your research, did you find anything about these people who have the imaginary friend children?
It's very interesting. You know, we always say our children's imaginary friends are, you know, children that they make up, imaginary playmates to keep them company. You know, most of the time that's the case. But sometimes, you know, we have found that imaginary friends actually have, pardon me, an identity or an entity of their own. Sometimes they turn out to be children that lived in the home or the apartment before, who died in the apartment or the home, that are still around. And the children will be able to name them by name, give their birthday, the day that they died, particulars about their favorite books, their favorite toys, the names of their parents. Sometimes it seems that these children are spirits that have been brought home from places, particularly from hospitals that children have visited. When they visited loved ones in the hospital, they will bring the entities of children home with them. And it's interesting because children's spirits seem to attach themselves to living children, you know, to play with. It's one of the saddest things and one of the most fascinating things for me over the years of investigating haunted places here in Chicago, the private homes that I've gone into over the years where parents have had a child that has passed away. And you will go into the house, and the parents believe that the child's still there. They've seen the child, or their rooms, the objects in their rooms are moved around, and they're worried that the child has not passed on properly. So you go into the house, and invariably you will find that their bedrooms are absolutely intact. The bedding's all there, the toys, the books, the clothing. More than one occasion I've seen the pajamas or the clothing laid out as if the child was going to, you know, live another day. And it's not surprising that these children still seem to be here, because when you think about a child, their whole life is their home and their parents, maybe a couple of friends or their siblings, their room, their house. And it makes it very difficult, it seems, for children to move on, or perhaps for the parents to let them go. And again, we don't know if these are, you know, actually the spirits of the dead, or if they're, you know, really sort of subjective figments of our imagination or of our desires, but there's something there that's still very much alive, whether it comes from our wishful thinking or whether it comes from the other side. and two, you know, let these thoughts or these wishes or these entities go is something we have to be conscious of when we lose a child. Otherwise, you might find that the living children definitely do have playmates that aren't quite the invisible friends that we have traditionally thought they were.
I'm talking to Ursula Bielski, and for those people of a nervous disposition, before I mention the next subject, maybe it's time to switch your radio off, because this is quite unnerving, and I'm interested to know what you've got to say about this. You have got experiences of a number of toys that are haunted. Tell me about that.
Yes, absolutely. The thing I think in our modern day, after some of the movies like Child's Play and Chucky and Bride of Chucky and things like that, and then there was that old said Anthony Hopkins with the movie with the ventriloquist dummy that came to life and killed people. It's interesting. There have actually been real life cases where dolls have seemingly come to life and have actually seemed to have done harm to the living. And I know since the book has been out for the last couple of months, the story that is so chilling, the number one story that's so chilling to people is the story of Annabelle the doll. And this is a life-size Raggedy Ann doll, life-size rag doll, that was pretty much taken into custody by the great demonologists and paranormal researchers Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are from the East Coast here in the United States. They have been investigating the paranormal for many years. Ed passed away just a couple of years ago, and his wife, Lorraine, still continues their work. Annabelle the doll was this doll that was given to this young woman. She was a nursing student, by her mother, just as kind of a gift, as a decoration for her room. And for some reason, there was some kind of paranormal activity that was going on in the apartment, which the young woman lived in with a friend of hers, another nursing student. And as they sort of gave a name to the doll and started addressing the doll almost as if it were human, they started to find that the doll seemed to take on a life of its own. And they had a medium come into the apartment, and they had a seance, and the medium said that there was a spirit of a little girl named Annabelle living in the apartment. So they started calling the doll Annabelle. Well, things worsened to the point where one of the girl's boyfriends was actually attacked by the doll, and the doll left scratches on his body and almost choked him one night as well. So they finally called Ed and Lorraine Warren to come in and investigate, and Lorraine Warren, who is also a medium, announced that there was actually a demon that was possessing the doll, and they had an exorcism done to rid the doll of the spirit, and it sort of worked, but sort of didn't work. They ended up taking the doll with them back to Connecticut, where they lived, and the doll today is in the Warren's Occult Museum on the East Coast. And it's in a glass case with warning signs posted all over it. And even now, the doll has been credited over the years with several so-called accidents that have occurred to people that have made fun of the doll or kind of provoked it when they've seen it. And that's an interesting case. Another famous, you know, haunted doll is Robert the doll, who resides in Key West, Florida. He was the doll that belonged to Gene Otto. He was a son of a wealthy family in Key West, and he treated this doll as his best friend, really like a sibling, and the doll pretty much took over the house, and the staff would hear the doll talking, and everyone in the house was afraid of the doll, and the doll was believed to have caused all sorts of havoc in the house. And even today, in that house, which is now a bed and breakfast, the artist's house, things go wrong. They say, Robert did it. So the doll is still accused of these things that go on. So very interesting. These very, seemingly benign playthings really seem to take on a life of their own if we give them the opportunity to.
Dan's emailed me and wants me to ask you a question. He's done lots of research on this, hours of it, in fact, and he wants to know, do you think there's a connection between aliens and the paranormal?
Oh, absolutely. In the last few years, it's been so gratifying because there is so much of the research that seems to be overlapping, where we're finding that a lot of the phenomena that are all classified as paranormal but have been categorized differently over the years, ghosts and hauntings, poltergeists, UFOs, cryptozoology, that a lot of these things seem to have a lot of similarities and may be one of the same phenomena. I really honestly do believe that a lot of the experiences, a lot of paranormal investigators or ghost researchers are very much focused on ghosts and hauntings and don't really bring aliens or UFOs into the picture. I really do believe that a lot of experiences that people have with so-called ghosts or hauntings are experiences with alien visitations. And I also think that a lot of experiences that people have with creatures such as Bigfoot here in the United States, Sasquatch, the abominable snowman, and other beings, I think a lot of these beings are going to be found to be real and that they've eluded us because they do have paranormal abilities and they are able to know that we're near and to stay away from us. And I think we're going to find over the years that what started in the last few years is that this awareness of the overlap of a lot of this paranormal phenomena is just going to increase in the years that come.
Do you think people like yourself, and it's big business these days, but do you think people like yourselves are offending the spirit world? Do you think the spirit world don't want to be prodded, don't want to be investigated?
It's interesting. There's all of these programs that we have on TV now, Most Haunted and Ghost Hunters and all these shows that we have. I'm offended by them. I started out investigating, almost 25 years ago. And back then it was very different. The sort of scientific or evidential side of it was, it was just a part of it. And I was offended back then when I first started out because the first work I did was as part of a research team of a friend that was a psychology student. He was doing field work in parapsychology. And my job was to interview people and get the history behind a place. And I would interview sometimes dozens of people that had very profound experiences at the site that we're going to investigate. We would go in, set up all of the equipment, and after 24 or 48 hours, if nothing scientific had happened to produce evidence of the paranormal, the site was dismissed as unhaunted, and it was a done deal. It was all over. And I was horrified because I had talked to so many people that had these experiences that had profoundly affected their lives, and sometimes they're complete perception of the universe and everything. And I find that I'm very offended as an investigator by this very focused idea on all of these gadgets and all the scientific equipment. The thing about the paranormal which makes it so difficult is because you can't look at it that way, and any parapsychologist knows that. You can't look at the paranormal head-on like you can in any other scientific discipline. You have to look at it sort of out of the corner of your eye. And I think, like, the first question you asked, I think that's what makes it so appealing, is that you can't ever really grasp it. You can never really look at it. And, I think whatever's out there does get very irritated sometimes. And, sometimes, when we started out, we knew not to go into anywhere with more than three or four people because we knew that had a direct effect on the kind of results that we would get, fewer results the more people that we had. This is very quiet phenomena. It's very elusive phenomena, and it needs a very gentle hand. And I don't think that's something that a lot of people these days are going at it with.
Tell me, with your investigations, are there spirits out there, evil, wicked spirits that take over children and destroy their lives?
It's interesting. The work with children really does bring to light some of the more dark phenomena that goes on and the more destructive phenomena that goes on. There are things like poltergeist phenomena. Poltergeist phenomena is widely believed today to reside or to originate in the mind of adolescents particularly, and that it's not, you know, anything spooky or ghostly at all, but it's children's minds acting out in these ways that we don't understand yet. And they can be very destructive. I wrote in the book about the case of Tina Rush. Very strange case. Tina Rush was a former foster child that grew up in Columbus, Ohio in the 1980s. And she had a troubled childhood. She didn't have a good time of it at school. She ended up being homeschooled by her foster parents. And when she was about 14 years old, all sorts of strange things started happening in our house. First of all, to the electronics and the appliances in the kitchen going awry. There was one incident where the eggs in the refrigerator actually shot through the closed refrigerator door and broke on the kitchen floor. There were sconces on the living room wall that rotated 360 degrees. There were, you know, plastic fruit that rolled down the hallways and furniture that moved and all these sorts of things. And there was a famous photograph taken in the Rush home. Tina was sitting in one of the living room chairs, and the phone that was on the table next to her shot across her body, and the reporter snapped the picture. It's in the book. This famous flying phone photograph was one of many that were taken at the home, and Tina had this terrible, tragic life. It was found out later on that she had started faking the phenomenon in the house. William Rohl, the late, great parapsychologist, who was probably the greatest poltergeist researcher ever, stayed in the home for several weeks and studied Tina and became great friends with her for the rest of her life. And she ended up going to be studied in the laboratory at the Ryan Research Center, the offshoot of the Duke University Parapsychology Lab, and she was found to have a mild case of Tourette syndrome with very jerky body movements and a very bad nervous system. And William Rohl believed that this was, you know, the cause of the phenomena that had happened in the house, that she was somehow projecting this nervous activity out into the environment. Tina went on to actually have a series of bad romances, and she had a little girl who died. And Tina ended up pleading guilty to the murder of her two-year-old daughter named Amber. And it was found after the death of the child that Tina's boyfriend had sodomized the child and that Tina's boyfriend was home alone with the child at the time of the death. Tina was miles away at a friend's house. And yet Tina pled guilty to the murder to avoid being being sentenced with capital punishment. She's in jail today. She got 20 years plus a life sentence. And William Rohl and a lot of researchers believe that Tina pled guilty to the murder because her experience with the poltergeist phenomena taught her that people would not believe anything that she said. So it's a very, very tragic case, kind of the extreme of what terrible things can happen when the paranormal is not understood in the lives of children.
But I've got to say that James has emailed in to say what a fascinating lady you are.
Thank you.
I must admit, I agree. A couple of more questions. It hit me that if somebody was locked in prison, there's nowhere for them to go, and there was ghosts or spirits or entities in prison, they're in trouble, aren't they? And right now, by the way, there's a major prison in Liverpool, well, there's two, that will be listening. Every listener, every inmate will be listening to this. So go ahead and give us the facts. If you want to scare them, scare them.
Yeah, I have to say there are no places that are more actively haunted today or any time than prisons and mental institutions that have been closed down. You know, here in the United States, Alcatraz Island is one of the most haunted places in the country, and also places like Mansfield Reformatory, Mansfield, Ohio, and places like this. And we really believe that this the reason why these places are so haunted is because of the confinement. There seems to be, with all spirits, a direct connection between how the life experience is, how open it is, and how the afterlife experience is, how open that is. So if you are confined in your life before your death to a small place, to a certain number of people, to a limited number of experiences for, you know, years, that when you die, that's what's open to you. We have studied so many cases of people that have had life after death experiences or near death experiences, and they come back from their momentary time on the other side, and people ask them, what is important in life? What did you learn that we should hang on to in life, that we should care about in life? And everyone says the same thing, love and learning. And when they're asked about it, they all say, you have to open your mind, keep your mind open, learn new things, meet new people, go new places, because there's a direct correlation between how wide your breath is here and how wide your opportunities are on the other side. So it's not surprising that when people are confined, whether they're in a prison or in a hospital, especially, it's so sad in the cases of mental institutions, where people are not only confined physically, but confined, their minds are confined.
Yeah.
In the very sad personal world that they have, where they can't interact with other people or can't understand other people or can't express themselves. So it's not surprising that people remain confined in these places after they die. So these are some of the most haunted places there are.
Diane sent me an interesting email. She said that last Friday, she said, I can't sleep. It was 4 o'clock and I felt a hand on my back patting me gently. I had a really overwhelming sadness and a really strange feeling. And the next day, my friend's daughter rang to tell me that my friend had died at 4 a.m. and I didn't even know she was in hospital.
This is one of the most common experiences that there is, the experience of someone beloved to us at the moment of death, without us knowing anything about it. One of the first stories I ever heard was when I was a little girl. I was probably 4 years old, and my mom told the story of my Uncle Will, who was one of her brothers, and he had gone off to fight in World War II, and he had gone in December of 1941, and there was no, you know, R&R back then. There was no leave back then. He was gone for 4 years. They never saw him. And after 4 years, my grandparents, my mom's parents, woke up at the same time in their bedroom, and they saw William standing at the foot of the bed, dressed in his army uniform, but he looked just like he did the day that he left, but his whole body was draped in a translucent black veil, covering the top of his head and going down to the floor. Well, my grandmother and grandfather jumped out of bed to embrace William. They hadn't seen him in 4 years. They were so happy that he was home. And they said as soon as their feet hit the floor, he disappeared. And the next day they got a telegram from the War Department informing them that William had been killed in an explosion on an airfield on Saipan Island. This experience is probably, Pete, if I was going to say, I would say it's the number one experience that people have, this experience of seeing a loved one or experiencing a loved one at the moment of death. There are so many experiences where people will hear the doorbell ring or hear a knock on the door or see the doorknob turn and find out a few minutes later that a loved one has died. Just so many experiences like this.
Angelo, have vampires crossed into the paranormal, or is that a separate entity?
You know, it's interesting. There's so much talk about vampires nowadays, and I think, you know, it's one of those things. excuse me, that we mentioned, where there's so much overlap. And it's interesting for me growing up here in Chicago. I come from a family of police officers. And well, my brother started out, he's a sergeant now, but he started out doing tactical work in a very rough neighborhood here in Chicago. And so like an artistic neighborhood here on the north side. And he had several calls when he started out where he came onto the scene. And there were, you know, couples that said that they were vampires that were literally drinking each other's blood or biting each other. And it's definitely, definitely something that goes on. It's definitely something like lycanthropy, werewolfism, that people believe that they are vampires or are werewolves. As far as, you know, the reality of it, I think the reality of all of this stuff may someday be found out to be sort of the limits of our imagination. And, you know, we've done research and found that people that believe that they're vampires, they seem to be healthier than other people. They seem to live longer than other people. They seem to look a lot younger than other people. And this is, you know, probably the result of positive thinking and thinking in tune with what they believe that they are. And this is really, I think, is going to turn out to be what the paranormal is all about, you know, mind over matter, and realizing the power that we ourselves and our minds have over physical reality.
You're a fascinating woman. I could speak to you all night. You really are a fascinating woman. How can they find your books?
Everything about me is on our website, which is www.chicagohauntings.com. And that has information about all of my books, information about all sorts of history and hauntings here in Chicago. It has links to all sorts of resources about the paranormal all over the world. Has information for our tours or anyone that might be visiting Chicago someday. And just a lot of great information about investing in the paranormal in general. So that's chicagohauntings.com.
Do tell me, somebody like yourself who has investigated for so long and is involved, do you fear death?
I think like a lot of people, I fear dying. But I wouldn't say looking forward to dying, but I'm trying to live my life, as I mentioned, learning as much as I can and being as open as I can to the experience of the afterlife. I certainly believe in it and convinced of it. So I'm just, I guess I'm more afraid of not doing everything I can to prepare to make the most of it. Let's say it that way.
So the latest book is There's Something Under My Bed.
Yes.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful night.
I won't sleep.
Good, I've done my job.
Bye-bye, Ursula.
Good night.
Bye-bye. That was Ursula Bialski.
Late Night City with Pete Price on Radio City 96.7 and City Talk 105.9.